cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Tim's been talking about it. I've been talking about it. We've got the U.S. Federal Reserve kicking off that two-day meeting on monetary policy today. We're talking about the policy-setting arm of the Fed. Decision, of course, comes tomorrow. At this time, 24 hours, fast forward, we will be hearing from Jay Powell in that press conference.
We got with us Matt Bosler. He's Federal Reserve reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from our New York City Bureau. Matt, good to have you with us this afternoon. I know you're busy ahead of this. Well, I don't want to say ahead of the meeting because it's happening now, but ahead of tomorrow's press conference. You have a great piece out today about the dual mandate that the Fed has, stable prices and maximum employment. But one of those things is getting a lot more attention right now, and that, of course, is stable prices. So how is that employment mandate taking a back seat?
Thanks, Tim. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the Fed has made fighting inflation and bringing it down to their 2% target job number one this year. And so, you know, as of the last meeting in September, they actually came out for the first time with projections showing that they need to boost the unemployment rate, you know, almost a full percentage point through the end of next year to bring inflation down to where they want it to be. And this is really the first time since they started publishing these projections 10 years ago that they've put out such a kind of dark forecast for what their policy is going to do to the unemployment rate. And so it's a really interesting time right now where they're dealing with, you know, increasingly calls from Democratic lawmakers, including Senator Liz Warren today, for them to slow down and remember that they actually have two mandates and it's not just all about inflation.
Yeah, it's rare, though, right, among global central banks, Matt?
Yeah, it is. And so, you know, the Fed has an employment mandate. Most other central banks only have the one inflation mandate. And there's a really interesting history behind the Fed's employment mandate, right? It goes back to the civil rights movement in the United States back in the 1960s and the 1970s. This was really the work of civil rights activists who pushed for this and got it codified into law at the end of the 1970s. It was really kind of like the last dying breath of the civil rights movement, if you will, to get this on the books.
But I mean, isn't the data that we continue to get showing us that the labor market is so resilient? I mean, take that JOLTS number this morning, that it kind of can take a backseat to fighting inflation. Because as you write, back in 1981, inflation was high and unemployment was high too.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so the labor market has, you know, been so resilient all year, and everybody's just kind of waiting for it to slow down, right? And we're not seeing that in the data yet, even though we've had these very aggressive rate increases. So on one hand, you know, perhaps you might not expect it to show up in the data just yet because, you know, the Fed really only started doing these rate increases about 7 months ago. And as we know, it takes time for monetary policy to work through the economy. But, you know, as the labor market data keep coming in so strong, it's also causing forecasters to, you know, ratchet up their projections for where the Fed is going to ultimately raise interest rates to. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword in that regard, that this, you know, continued strong labor market data makes it look like the Fed is going to have to be even more hawkish than previously planned to bring inflation down. And that's kind of where they are at the moment.
Matt, I love you kind of give us a history lesson when it comes to monetary policy, taking us back to Humphrey Hawkins and reminding us once again of the Volcker era, maybe what we've learned. But what's interesting, too, though, in your reporting and writing is something that we talk a lot about, in that some of the inflationary pressures are above and beyond Fed control. And so you do wonder, with this dual mandate, whether we need to be thinking that, wait, guys, the Fed can only do so much when it comes to inflation. And if they overdo it, it's at what risk and what cost to the labor market. And so this is where you wonder whether policymakers have to come in and kind of give the Fed an assist here.
Right. And, you know, that's pretty much been completely acknowledged by the Fed, right, for the most part. I mean, the one thing that they do say is that, look, we do have a very strong labor market. Wage growth is very high. And even after some of these temporary supply side driven factors, kind of resolve themselves and fall out of the inflation data, we're still going to be left with very high inflation. And so there is room for us to tamp down on the labor market with demand side policy. Now, that's a kind of a big hypothetical. You know, we don't really know where inflation is going to settle out, but that's the story that they're sticking with at the moment.
But it's hard to have a Fed where the employment and inflation mandates are in conflict, as you report. I mean, this is not an easy thing to navigate. Matt Bosler, a really smart read. And this story, by the way, is going to be in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which is out later this week. It's already on the Bloomberg terminal at Bloomberg.com, but be sure to pick up that magazine. Matt, by the way, is Federal Reserve reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone in our New York City bureau.
You didn't give Matt the question that you wanted to ask Chair Powell tomorrow.
I'm still working on
it. Okay, still working on it. Yeah, pivot? I'm still thinking about
pivot?
It, too.
What's a pivot mean? What? Is a pivot like not so aggressive? Is it cutting rates? Is it what?
What pivot are we talking about?
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Blake Masters is betting that more money from Peter Thiel, Donald Trump, and conservative activists, plus some rallies with Carrie Lake, can help put the GOP in control. We're talking about Arizona. With that story, our own Bloomberg Businessweek columnist, Max Chafkin.
He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Max's story is featured in the upcoming issue of Businessweek magazine, but it's available now on the Bloomberg terminal at Bloomberg.com/Businessweek. Okay, let's think back to the 2020 election, Max, and Arizona, a pivotal state. But it ended up going for President Biden.
Josh Green wrote a really prescient story in 2020, basically predicting or speculating on the possibility that Arizona would turn purple and that the thing that would drive it purple would be the Maricopa County suburbs. And, you know, Arizona is kind of an interesting state because it sort of was the pioneer of this kind of right-wing populism. Sheriff Joe Arpaio, in a lot of ways, was a proto-Trump. And in 2020, that stuff looked like it was in the rearview mirror. Joe Biden won the state. Arpaio has lost, like, the last three elections he's contested. So the state is trending bluer and away from the kind of, you know, sort of hardline right. But what we're seeing in 2022 with, you know, a relatively unpopular president, high inflation, and so on, that sort of right wing that has been there in Arizona is surging right now. And it is what Blake Masters and Carrie Lake and some of these other candidates that are running in the state are betting on. And you know, if they're successful, obviously it could have serious implications both for the Senate and for 2024.
What is interesting, kind of understanding, like, who's funding who in that state and what's going on behind the scenes?
Right. So Masters is interesting because he's a political outsider, and he was basically a protege to Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley investor.
Did he help write the book?
Yeah, exactly. famous because he was co-founder of PayPal. He was one of the early backers of Facebook. Yeah, wrote a whole book about him. And he basically plucked a couple of Senate candidates out of relative obscurity, J.D. Vance in Ohio and Masters, who really had no profile whatsoever besides basically being known as Peter Thiel's right-hand man, gave him a $10 million seed investment and basically carried him through the Republican primary. And then when we got to the general election, Masters has had a much harder time. Thiel had not been funding him for a couple of months, and partly because Thiel has sort of pushed Masters, I think, to the right, you saw a hesitancy from sort of more mainstream Republicans like Mitch McConnell to fund the campaign. So there's been this kind of dance, right, where you have on one side the sort of mainstream Republicans, Mitch McConnell, and then on the other side these kind of activists with Peter Thiel and Donald Trump. Trump being kind of
so no real unity, right? Like, as you point out, when it comes to the Republicans in this state.
Yeah, what's so interesting is, especially Arizona, is you have an entire ticket statewide of basically Trumpists, of candidates who say that the 2020 election was in some sense stolen. Carrie Lake at the top of that ticket, Blake Masters has made kind of similar comments, and you also have candidates for Attorney General and Secretary of State mm-hmm. kind of saying the same thing. So it's a real test, I think, for sort of that message, the Stop the Steal conspiracy. Can that actually like win you an election in a swing state? But it's also, of course, a test for the popularity of Donald Trump and you know, the popularity of Democrats, frankly.
Okay, so what do the data tell us right now? What do the polls tell us?
It's very close.
Dare you bring up polls? No, just kidding. Go ahead.
So Lake is running a little bit ahead of Masters. I think she's even or slightly ahead of her Democratic opponent, which is interesting. That's one of people in the Republican Party now are talking about her as a rising star. I went to this event in Arizona. They kept referring to her as R. Ron DeSantis, which that was kind of funny. But in any case, and there's speculation, she could be a potential, you know, vice presidential candidate if Trump runs in 2024. Masters has, you know, not proven as successful a candidate. He also has a, you know, probably a better opponent, Mark Kelly, who's an incumbent, has raised a ton of money. And so he's running a bit behind Lake, although he is very close as well. And, you know, at this point, it could probably go either way.
So how do you, like, you do this story and we're looking at some really kind of key, pivotal, as we always are, states in the upcoming midterms and certainly it'll ultimately in the next presidential run. I mean, how do we kind of square what's going on in Arizona versus kind of more broadly across the country? How do you think about that?
I think that the same kind of forces are at play, you know, in other states, which is that you have this small but very engaged subset of the electorate, the sort of Trump portion of the electorate, which is you know, it's not a majority, but they're extremely enthused, and the question is, you know, are they going to turn out, especially in a midterm year when Donald Trump is not on the ballot, and the extent to which, you know, these Trump-aligned candidates have, you know, won their primaries and kind of become the main forces in their states, and this cuts across other states as well. You know, it really just shows how Donald Trump is still, you know, very much the most important person in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. On the donor side, you know, there's a very interesting kind of drama between Thiel and as I said, the kind of more moderates, because Thiel kind of foisted these harder line candidates on the Republican Party, carried them through their primary campaigns. And, you know, if they lose, that's going to be a huge blow for him. It's going to look like he wasted, you know, over $30 million, you know, promoting unelectable candidates. If they win, though, it's going to be a huge win for Thiel. We'll have pushed the Republican Party to the right, you know, and I would expect he would then play probably a pretty important role in 2024.
What about economic messaging, Max? Because if we think about, you know, for example, here in New York, and the reason why Lee Zeldin is pulling closer and closer to Kathy Hochul, the incumbent, is about crime and the economy. Mostly crime, but I'm wondering about the economic message because we see that resonating across the country in different states. Is that happening in Arizona?
Yeah. I mean, Masters and Lake are talking about inflation just like everybody else is talking about inflation. Although I think they're less offering a plan and more sort of offering a critique, which is that, you know, the Democrats have let us down and so on. And it's very much a message about sort of culture type stuff, and as you said, crime and immigration. In Arizona, of course, immigration is a big thing, right? So Masters is hitting his Democratic opponent primarily on inflation and immigration, saying the border is out of control and things like that. It really is similar to Trumpism and similar to the Trump messaging that we've seen in past elections.
Well, and key too will be how it plays out for the Secretary of State races, right, too, because if, again, there's a contested race or election outcome, I mean, these are the guys that can decide. It just got about 20 seconds.
Yeah, right? Arizona's interesting because the Secretary of State candidate, Mark Finchem, who is allied with Lake and Masters, is a very hard line, you know, borderline conspiracist. And so if he's able to win, you know, that'll be a huge vindication for the Trump folks and could have implications for 2024.
Oh, my gosh. Unbelievable. Well, the midterm's what? Just a week away.
Yes, 1 week, Carol. One week from today.
Exactly.
I voted early here in New York.
I did not. Max, thank you so much. Max Chafkin, of course, columnist at Bloomberg Businessweek. Check out his story in the upcoming new issue of Businessweek, out on newsstands later this week, already on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com.
It's a great story. Check it out online and, of course, on the terminal as well. And then later this week, as Carol mentioned, in the magazine. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You've got a very, very special guest with us right now.
Yeah, a former beloved Bloomberg colleague.
I still beloved him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If that's a way to describe things.
Former Bloomberg. Well, he's still beloved, but he's a former Bloomberg colleague. It's that kind of a day. Carl Riccadonna is now the chief U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, and he's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
It's great to hear you. I heard you on radio and TV this morning.
Yes, on Surveillance earlier this morning.
It was really good. You're doing well.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, now we'll talk about the important stuff. So let's talk about this meeting tomorrow.
What meeting, Carol?
Yeah, Fed meeting.
Oh, that one, okay.
What's top of mind for you?
Top of mind is going to be the signaling in the press conference. As we kind of look at the meeting statement from the prior meeting and think of what needs to change at this meeting, it could be as little as the date stamped on the meeting statement. So it's all about the press conference and the kind of signaling towards what they'll do in December. And knowing Jay Powell and how he operates, I don't see any reason for him to get out in front of this.
Is he going to use the word pivot?
The market is close to 50-50 split between 50 and 75 at the December meeting.
Okay.
And I think he's going to let the data do the talking. So he'll say there's two more jobs reports, two more inflation reports, rounds of inflation expectations data.
Yeah.
And so we will look at, using his word from the last meeting, the totality of the data determine. He'll say that at some point, right, we can't do 75s forever. There will be a point where it is appropriate to downshift.
It may be
December, but we're not sure yet, and we'll base our decision on the upcoming data, right? The Fed has made it very clear this year they are acting on realized data, not forecasts.
Okay, Carl, there's a difference, though, between downshifting and pausing rate hikes.
Right.
So just help us understand the environment that we're entering in 2023. Do we go to one where we continue to see rate hikes of 25 basis points or 50 basis points at meeting after meeting? Or do we just get to a point where the Fed reaches the terminal rate? And I would love to hear what you think the terminal rate is going to be.
Sure.
And leaves it there for what? How long?
Well, the level of rates matters relative to the growth rate in the economy. So if we look at GDP right now, we're growing at about a 9% pace. The Fed funds rate is far below that, right? So it's not as restrictive as it might seem. But we see that growth is decelerating sharply. The housing sector obviously heading into a pretty significant contraction, maybe a 25% annualized decline in the back half of this year. We see the factory sector starting to respond to the strength in the dollar, which has crimped export demand and whatnot. So we see more parts of the economy starting to creak as Fed tightening weighs in on the economy. Our baseline view is that we will get another 75 basis point hike at the December meeting, another 50 basis points in the first quarter of next year, probably at the February meeting. That gets us to a terminal Fed funds rate of 5.25.
Wait, so 75 this meeting.
75 in December.
Got it.
And then 50 in Q1. Probably 50 at the February meeting,
okay.
Right? It could be 25-25 between February and March, but we don't want to forecast around two corners. So the downshift is coming, maybe not in time for December, but with the Fed funds rate north of 5%, unfortunately, I have to use that R word on your program, Carol,
recession.
And we think that this means recession in the first half
of next
year.
Are we there already?
We're not there already because we still have positive income growth in the economy. We're creating positive monthly gains in employment, which is a very important barometer of recession. So we're not quite there yet, but things are slowing, and I think this will become more evident when we see payrolls on Friday and over the course of this quarter, and especially as we get into Q1 of next year.
What would be recessionary about payrolls on Friday? I mean, we're guessing 195-ish right,
right.
now.
Right. So if we're close to, you know, what's recessionary about that is the direction of travel. So I'm at about 215,000 on that forecast, but we're cooling from a pace of, you know, 400, 500,000 per month earlier this year. So if we extend that trend, it doesn't become recessionary necessarily in Q4, but by the first part of next year, then we're getting into the realm of a negative payroll print coming in. Whether there's one, they're like cockroaches. There will be multiple, and that probably means that we've slid into contraction. And just the last point I would add to that, consumers have been surfing on a wave of excess savings, right? This has propped up consumers, even while inflation is high, to levels of performance and consumption that wouldn't otherwise be possible.
They're still working down the money.
But those savings are, you know, poised to run dry, so to speak, in the first half of next year, right? We're burning through about $1 trillion of excess savings per quarter.
Wow.
We started at about, you know, just north of $2 trillion. And so, you know, just use that math, and that shows you that the tank runs on the fumes in Q1 of next year.
Hey, Carl, one of the big discussions we've been having, like on the other side of this, as we get our way through this Fed cycle, should we just, as a civilization, just say, hey, inflation's going to run a little bit hotter than it has traditionally because of things that are going on more broadly, strategically, and fundamentally? About 40 seconds.
I think we're in a regime shift on inflation where a lot of factors, whether it's deglobalization or moving away from petroleum and whatnot, carbon-emitting fuel, energy sources.
Demographics,
all of these things could mean higher inflation. But if the Fed is focused on getting it to 2%, that just means there will be a more restrictive Fed response. So we said recession next year. Typically in recession, the Fed is the white knight riding to the rescue, cutting quickly and aggressively.
Yeah.
I don't think we can count on that to happen this time around. They're going to keep a foot on the brake pedal to make sure they wring the inflation pressures out of the system.
Yes or no? The Fed still thinks 2% inflation is real?
Absolutely. They are not abandoning that target anytime soon.
Wow. Got a ways to go.
They will risk the chagrin of the U.S. Congress if they do.
That would be a pivot. Carl Riccadonna, so great to see you.
Sure
Chief
thing.
U.S. Economist at BNP Paribas, joining us here in studio.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I don't want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just under 10 minutes until we ring the closing bell on this Tuesday session of trade. First trading day in November, and we are seeing stocks off their worst levels of the session, but pretty much down across the board. So let's get to it. Our Drive to the Close guest is with us.
We got Amanda Agati with us, Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group. She joins us on the phone from Philadelphia. I always think of the 12 what? Rings of Christmas when
right.
I think of Amanda Agati because...
It's not so far away.
It's not. That's what I was going to say. Now that we're in November, we're going to get closer, and I don't want to know what inflationary things look like this year. So stay tuned for, you know, around Christmas time when Amanda comes back. But before we get there, Amanda, we have got a long way to go because we got a Fed meeting that has kicked off today. We hear from Fed Chair Jay Powell tomorrow. Markets were very optimistic in October. What's top of mind for you right now?
Well, thanks so much for having me. We're definitely excited to share the insights from the Christmas Price Index. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. But the thing that's certainly top of mind right now is ultimately what the Fed does in terms of action items here and also in terms of forward guidance. And so I think from our perspective, 75 basis points is pretty much a foregone conclusion in terms of the action item coming out of the meeting. But what isn't entirely clear is the guidance that they're going to provide or ultimately, you know, where the end state for monetary policy ends. And, you know, I could talk all day about, you know, the still somewhat solid underlying fundamentals, the health of the consumer, what's going on in credit markets. Even some of the economic data today looked okay-ish. But I think the only thing that really matters in terms of the path forward is what the Fed does.
Well, no, it's a really good point. Well, how would you assess what you're seeing in terms of the economic backdrop and market backdrop and what that means and what that portends for corporate earnings going forward? We're still, of course, going through earnings, but what it means perhaps going into next year?
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of the economic data that came out today, there's clearly some slowing and some settling, you know, prices, levels coming down. And it's really a reflection of the Fed doing what they're trying to do, right? They're tightening financial conditions. They're slowing down the backdrop. But the frustrating part about this is for as aggressive and hawkish as they have been in terms of, you know, these consistent outsized rate hikes, it hasn't really made that much of a difference in terms of the inflationary backdrop. We haven't made that much progress. And it comes back to this idea that there's a perfect storm of headwinds swirling here that the Fed's policy tools in the toolkit really aren't effective at combating.
Well, Amanda, sorry to jump in. I just want you to talk about some of those specific headwinds here that have you concerned because it does seem pretty puzzling that, you know, despite, well, not puzzling because we know this stuff takes time, but I think frustrating to a lot of people that where we see softness now is housing, but kind of nowhere else.
Right. So some of the challenges that we're seeing are certainly, you know, as it relates to the pandemic itself and the grip that it continues to have, even though it may feel like we're kind of getting back to normal business as usual pre-pandemic, there's still a grip there in terms of the pandemic itself, and it's showing up in the flickering on and off and lockdowns as it relates to China and other parts of Asia. There's still some pretty significant supply chain disruptions. We certainly have Russia and Ukraine applying a ton of pressure on commodity prices and energy prices in particular. Just because the Fed raises rates or tapers their balance sheet at a more accelerating rate, does that have any impact on those key variables? You know, so I keep coming back to this idea that there's a perfect storm here that's driving inflation here. And so, you know, the Fed continues to raise rates, but I think we're getting to a point where we're not in overly restrictive territory, but we can easily tip into that place, and we ultimately end up with still elevated inflation in the backdrop.
All right, so what do we do? We've got money to put to work, or we're just trying to protect our assets. What do we do in this environment, Amanda?
Well, there's no question the valuation multiples have responded accordingly to the challenges that we've been facing this year. So from a valuation perspective, it definitely looks more attractive on a relative basis today than where we started the year. But we're still playing quite a bit of defense. The contrarian in me wants to start getting excited about new investment opportunities at major inflection points in the cycle. That's really where opportunities are born. But we're still playing quite a bit of defense here in the short run until we can get a better handle on how far and how fast the Fed is going to continue to move from here. So from our perspective, you got to go U.S. over international in terms of positioning, larger caps over smaller, and then we've effectively neutralized our growth versus value bet in equities. That one has been really challenging, kind of the pendulum swinging back and forth between growth and value all year. So that one hasn't really paid to kind of pick sides in terms of positioning in the path forward.
Amanda, when are we going to start to see some good news here? I got to tell you, I'm feeling a little pessimistic after hearing from you. Which is fine. I mean, it's your take on the markets. Mm-hmm. But when, you know, if we help us look forward to 2023, is there any optimism that you have?
So I don't want to be overly bearish sounding. I think it's just important to be a little cautious here at this point. I'm already getting my Christmas wish teed up for Santa here, and it's sort of the impossible thing, but I'm hoping for a December Fed pause. I don't think that I'm actually going to get it. I think my gift will get lost in supply chain disruptions. But I think, honestly, I keep coming back to this idea that the single most important variable for the path forward is where Fed policy ends. It's not so much one individual meeting or another. It's where that end state or terminal rate for monetary policy lands. And I think if we stop short of where the dot plot suggests the Fed is headed, we still have the potential to avoid recession. It's not a foregone conclusion at all. It just comes back to what the Fed ultimately chooses to do.
Well, it's an interesting time, that's for sure. Amanda, thank you so much. Amanda Gotti, she's Chief Investment Strategist over at PNC Asset Management Group, joining us on the phone in Philadelphia.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.